There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We are here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day and do so in real time. So that means we are talking about what people are talking about. Today we are definitely talking about Hurricane Irma pressing down even now on the Florida Keys. So we're going to be talking about that. How do we do that in a way that, you know, that honors Jesus Christ? How do we do that in a way that brings God back into the conversation? How do we do that from a Christian worldview, as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ in the midst of the world that he so loves? Well, that's what we talk about here on The Reconnect. You can also go and grab a lot of resources from reconnectwithcarmen.com. There's a lot of stuff I don't have time to talk about here on the air, but about which I want to share with you. And so go to reconnectwithcarmen.com, check out what we've got there for you, sign up for the email newsletter. And we will, you know, we'll just send commentary out to you from time to time that we think might be helpful in your efforts to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in conversations with your kids, your neighbors, your friends, people at church, you know, folks you're talking with. There you go. That's what we're doing. You can also like The Reconnect on Facebook, and you can let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. All right, we're going to lead off today with just a very straightforward news update on the status of Irma. So if you are listening to us on WTLN in our listening area in the greater Orlando area, just, you know, please know that you and your neighbors in Florida are certainly in our thoughts and prayers as, along with you, we watch this storm progress. The National Hurricane Center's next forecast is going to come at 5 p.m. Eastern time tonight. So what I can offer you right now is the 2 p.m. East Coast update. Hurricane Irma made landfall across a string of islands in the Caribbean. Barbuda took a major hit. 90% of its buildings have been damaged. St. Martin also took a very significant hit by this storm. Florida is certainly appears to be in Irma's direct path, but there are also now warnings related to the state of Georgia. And so let me just read a few things from this New York Times update. Again, there are live briefings for you at CNN.com, at TheNewYorkTimes.com, and various other news outlets. In St. Martin, an official said on Wednesday night that 95% of the island is basically destroyed. However, in Puerto Rico, I want to share with you, you know, we specifically prayed here in our office yesterday for Puerto Rico. I've got a colleague who has very dear friends who live there. And I want to read you this because I do think that we sometimes underestimate, maybe we underestimate the power of God, and therefore we underestimate the power of our prayers to him. That when we really beseech God, I'm not saying that, you know, that God's will is changed by our prayers, but there is certainly biblical evidence that the heart of God can be moved. And so we really only need a movement here of, like, you know, a wind velocity of like 5 miles per hour. If a reduction in 5 mile per hour winds actually makes a huge difference when you're talking about the difference in 180 and 175 miles per hour. I know that sounds a little crazy, but it's true. So in Puerto Rico, although nearly 70% of the households were without power, the governor there said on Thursday, "Our prayers have been answered. We would like to start out thanking the Almighty God," Mr. Frosello said, that the island actually experienced a relatively small impact by this storm. Puerto Rico has fallen trees and electrical poles that need to be repaired, but that is the bulk of the damage to the main island, he said. In short, our prayers were answered. So let us certainly be people who are in prayer for everyone in Irma's path. Irma sustained 185 mile per hour wind speeds for more than 24 hours. That's the longest period ever recorded. The French Weather Service described it as the most enduring superstorm on record. The French are actually paying not only really close attention to this, they have actually staged help. And so like St. Martin, it's going to be receiving literally barge loads of help. The French have barges actually staged for St. Martin and other islands that have relationships with them. The Dutch part of the island was the most severely hit, but the French intend to support them as well. So there are 100,000 French army rations being sent to two islands, enough to sustain the entire population there for a handful of days. So that's just to let you know that the response to these storms, you know, is going to be global in nature. But that does not get our friends in Florida and our friends in Georgia quite out of the way. And so I want to bring you up to date on advisories related to both Florida and Georgia. In the state of Florida, Governor Scott has been very, very clear. This is an urgent situation for all Florida families. He says Florida families, every Florida family, must prepare now to evacuate regardless of the coast that you live on. He has issued mandatory evacuations for South Florida, the Florida Keys, Lake Okeechobee, and something described as the Florida Bay, which I would just admit to you, being a person who grew up in Tampa Bay, I don't really know where Florida Bay is, but I'm betting that some of you do. So we also know from CNN's live update here that the roads out of Florida are already jammed and that gas is difficult to get in some places. I heard Governor Scott in an interview earlier today. He's giving very regular press briefings related to these things. They are escorting tanker trucks from refineries and from the coast directly to gas stations that are in need of fuel. And so gas is on its way. They have actually done what is necessary to sort of set regulations aside in order to distribute gasoline at a very high rate across the state of Florida. And they are doing so by military and police escort of tanker trucks. So if you see a tanker truck headed down the road, get out of its way because it's trying to supply gasoline to other people who are trying to evacuate. And you need those people to get out of your way so that you can get where you're going. Interstate 95 is going to be a mess. Everybody on the east coast of Florida is going to be getting on that one road and trying to head out. So I-75 might be a preferred route out of the state. For those of you who live in central Florida, I think you need to be prepared to accommodate your coastal friends. And let me just go ahead and say that all of us who live to the north of you are ready to receive evacuees from Florida. We recognize this has already proven to be a very deadly storm. And the doors of your neighbors are open. And so just come on north. Okay, so there's 1,350 miles of coastline and nearly 2.5 million homes are now in what is described as the hazard zone, more than three times of any other state. And so we're talking here about potential massive damage in Florida, depending on the particular path of Irma and depending on how strong she is when she arrives. And so let's just be praying specifically that the storm would weaken and that maybe it would just, you know, blow itself out into the Atlantic. Wouldn't that be nice? Just spin herself out back to the east and be done with it. Okay, my last thing here on Irma today is related to those of you who live in the state of Georgia. We actually have, let me scroll down to this piece of news here. We actually have a mandatory evacuation order from Governor Deal in the state of Georgia for everyone who lives east of I-95, which means if you live east of I-95, you need to be preparing to evacuate. This is the state of Georgia, my friends. We're talking about the entire city of Savannah, which is east of I-95. But so everybody from Jacksonville to Savannah is going to be trying to get on I-95 and headed out of town. And so the congestion on that particular interstate is only going to get worse as Georgia seeks to evacuate its coastline as well. And so let's be mindful to get out of people's way if we can. If you are in a position to head west instead of heading north, that might be the best route to take. All right, friends, let me move on from Irma here to, let me just lift up a completely different subject matter. Okay, so you know that I try to read really widely and I try to stay abreast of interesting things that are happening out there in the world and conversations that are taking place. And so yesterday, an article caught my attention from the Religion News Service. And so I am headed toward a conversation about an article by the Religion News Service. It's entitled All the President's Clergymen, a close look at Trump's unprecedented ties with evangelicals. So that caught my attention. You know, I'm on the board of the National Association of Evangelicals, particularly the influence that we have as Christians in terms of all levels of government matters to me. I believe that the church is in the world to be a positive influence and to advance the kingdom of Christ in the midst of this world. I'm not talking about a theocracy. I'm talking about the positive influence that Christ and his people desire to have in the world that he so loves. So I think that having access to the president and the opportunity to influence him is a great gift and potential advantage. This article by the Religion News Service sort of flips that whole thing on its head. So I want to get there. I want to get to the article, All the President's Clergymen. But before I go there, I just want to talk in general about the people, what we learn about people who meet with the president, what we learn about the president when he meets with people, and how to sort of recognize that every opportunity that you and I have to engage with another person in a conversation is an opportunity for us to influence them. So think about that for a moment. You know that I'm sort of, the hobby horse that I like to ride is that you and I are responsible to bring God back into every conversation. We're not just supposed to speak the truth into the world. We're supposed to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. We are supposed to be bringing God back into the conversations of the day. That is our calling. It's actually the name of my forthcoming book. Like, I'm not even very creative. I just stick with a theme and run with it. So this is what I think we are in the world to do. Speak the truth. Bringing God back into every conversation. And so I feel like when you have an audience with the president, the most powerful man in the world, that's what you should be doing. You should be speaking truth. And so before I get to the article about evangelicals and their access to the president and who is actually influencing whom, I want to lift up another article about a guy who had a meeting with the president and what he said about it. So this is about Steve Harvey. Now, Steve Harvey is, you know, what I might just describe as a media mogul. He's a TV host. He now has like 6 shows. He's even got a daytime talk show. He apparently really wants a nighttime, like a late night show. He's written a lot of books. You might recognize him as a comedian. Now, I would say he is one of the most influential African-American voices in the country today. Like, he has an authentic tone when he speaks. I think he speaks truth on a fair number of occasions. Well, he had an opportunity to meet with the president. He met with the president when the president was actually the president-elect. So this happened at Trump Tower. And in this interview piece that was posted, it's actually 18 pages long. This is quite a long interview piece in the Hollywood Reporter. I'm just going to read this one segment because, first of all, it's unusual, I think, in these pieces to see God directly referenced. And I also think that it is informative to hear what a person says about what they said in a conversation with the president of the United States. So obviously, this is not a conversation that was recorded in any way. This is Steve Harvey's recollection of his conversation with President Donald Trump before he was the president. So Steve Harvey says, in response to the Hollywood Reporter's question, earlier this year, you met with then President-elect Donald Trump. The reporter says, Steve Harvey contorts his face. Why are you making that face? Steve Harvey says, well, I didn't see that coming. Jesus. He called Uncle Tom a coon, a sellout, because I went to see a man, which only happened because my business partner got a call from the Obama transition team who said that the Trump transition team would like to set up a meeting. The Obama team said they thought it'd be a good idea because the president is encouraging dialogue. Well, I've got a relationship with Obama. We're friends. So I say, OK, cool. Now, here's the crazy thing. I'm supposed to be on a boat for my 60th birthday. So my wife says, Steve, just take off and skip the meeting. You'll meet with him some other time. Steve Harvey says in recollection, God, I should have listened to her. OK, so the reporter says, well, what did you and Trump discuss? Steve Harvey says, we talked about golf for 20 minutes, and then I told him, Mr. President, I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't vote for you. I campaigned very hard for Hillary Clinton. I said the problem was, he goes on to articulate why he thinks Clinton lost. And then he says, so I want you to know this. He says, but you've appointed Ben Carson as the head of housing and urban development, and I got ideas. I got keys to a lot of cities around the country from the years of performing that I've done, and I can get an ear to them really quickly, and I can find out what their real needs are. Y'all keep closing schools and cities, and I don't, So why don't we take those schools that we're closing and put some HUD money in them and reopen them as like vision centers and teach STEM and computers and coding? So just connect me with Ben Carson and I can help him with that. And a few minutes later, Steve Harvey says he had Carson on the phone. Meetings with Ben Carson have resulted in that. And actually, Steve Harvey anticipates that they'll be making the announcement of the first vision center opening in one of these previously closed inner city schools across America later this year. So what I'm pointing to here is that Steve Harvey recognized that he is a person of influence in certain communities. He also recognized the value of dialogue. Did he take it on the chin for going to this meeting? Absolutely. His own community basically berated him. I mean, the response to his meeting with the president was vicious and vociferous. But his follow-through is really important. Like, if you have access to the president, for whatever reason that access is given, if you have the opportunity to go into that meeting and to declare the truth, let me be honest with you, Mr. President, whatever that let me be honest with you, Mr. President is, you lay out what you can bring, what you can offer, and then you run with it. You absolutely run with it. So I want to lift this up as an example of what I view as a very positive outcome of having an opportunity to meet with the president. Notably, at the very end of this part of the interview, the reporter says, "Have you kept in touch with Trump?" Steve Harvey says, "No, I haven't talked to him since." I think Steve Harvey recognizes that, you know, this wasn't an opportunity to develop some sort of cozy relationship with President Trump. That's really not what he wanted. Steve Harvey wanted to leverage the power of the president and leverage his own power and those two things put together to actually bring some dramatic influence into inner city schools through this vision that he has for these vision centers to convert schools that have been closed into basically places where kids can learn computers and coding and focus on STEM, which we all know is the future in terms of jobs, not only here in America, but around the world. So it seems to me that comedian and media mogul Steve Garvey was like one of my baseball heroes when I was a kid. So sorry about that. He played for the LA Dodgers. He was the first baseman. If you don't know about him, like, he was a good guy too. Okay, but this is about Steve Harvey. Steve Harvey met with the president once. And what did we learn about him from that meeting? And what did we learn about the president from that meeting? Like, right? They're pragmatists. I think that's what we learn. We learn that people who have influence, have the opportunity to have access to the president, the influence game in that office is about pragmatism. What do you bring? What do I have? Who do we both know? What can we make happen together? I think it's about pragmatism. I've been saying that for a very long time, which leads me to this article posted by the Religion News Service entitled "All the President's Clergymen: A Close Look at Trump's Unprecedented Ties with Evangelicals." Now, there's four people who contributed to this: Adele Banks, Emily Miller, Yonat Shamron, and Jerome Sokolovsky. And so it's important to recognize that this is a piece that's contributed to by a number of people over the course of time. So there's a lot going on in this piece. I just want to share this with you. So this is about a group of Christian leaders. Well, I don't even know how to describe them really, because they're not technically a group. They're not, their names aren't listed anywhere. And it's different people at some of these different meetings, but at some of these meetings, it's all the same folks. So we're talking about meetings that took place on May the 3rd, July the 10th, July the 27th, and most recently on September the 1st. Again, not all of the same people are in all of the meetings, but some of them were. So according to the RNS story, as they filed into the Oval Office on July the 27th, President Trump greeted them warmly. Many of these people's names you would recognize, but I'm really not here to berate or malign the people who participated. I'm here to lift up an issue and a concern about influence and access. So that's what I'm going to stick with. President Trump greeted them warmly. This is the sentence, folks, that I want you to focus on. The President of the United States said about these evangelical leaders, "Now, this is a group that has real power. They have influence with God." Let's stop right there. Let's ask ourselves what that means and what it tells us about the president and what it tells us about the president's perspective of those evangelical leaders who are walking into the Oval Office at that moment. First of all, this is a conversation about access. Influence in politics and just about every other realm of life is about access. So the fact that this group of people has what is described as unprecedented access to the president, that is notable. But who is influencing whom is the question. If you're a Christian, the only legitimate reason to seek to gain access to the president is in order that you might influence him in the direction of the gospel's advance. That's it. That's the only reason to be in that office. That's the only reason to be with that guy. So that means that we seek not only the political points that might be earned among a particular constituency because we were seen in selfies with the president, but that we are actually advocating in his presence for that which is good and godly and true, that we are actually speaking the truth, that we are actually saying, Mr. President, I got to be honest with you. So back to the quote that leads off this particular meeting. Trump says of and to this very select group of people, now this is a group that has real power. They have influence with God. Real power. Remember who's talking and remember to whom he's talking, or remember who he's talking about. This is the president of the United States, arguably the most powerful man in the world. When he describes a group as having real power, is he acknowledging their spiritual authority? Is he seeking their counsel? Possibly. But the follow-up sentence suggests otherwise. They have real influence with God, Trump says. That suggests to me that the president is interested in influencing those who he perceives to have influence with God. Think about that for a moment. The president wants to give these people access in order that he can influence them because he thinks they influence God. Think about that for a moment. This turns the concept of spiritual influence completely on its head. The Christian does not seek to influence God on behalf of the president or on behalf of any particular nation. The Christian seeks to influence the president on behalf of God. We may find ourselves in the Oval Office, but we live in the throne room of God. We may find ourselves before the most powerful man in the world, but we live and breathe and find our being in the reality of the risen Christ who reigns forever and ever. So we may find ourselves among the council of the King of our day, but we have to never, ever forget who we really are and what we're really here to do. Serve as the ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. So the influence the president perceives this group of evangelical leaders to possess is influence not with some segment of the American population. It's not about the evangelical voter out there. Here we have to be perfectly clear. We do not have influence with God so much as we are influenced by God. We do not seek to bend or conform God's will to our preferred future. We allow the Holy Spirit to bring us into conformity with God's will, even when that seems utterly contrary to the world's way of thinking. The idea that Trump would be welcoming members of the clergy into the Oval Office in order to use the influence he believes they have with God is cause for concern. The president should have been corrected on the spot by someone who understands that the access won for us by Jesus Christ into the throne room of heaven is in every way superior to the momentary access granted to the Oval Office of the President of the United States, whoever that person may be. So, as a Christian, my primary responsibility when it comes to politics and the president is to pray for those in authority. But how I pray is the consideration that I think we must also address. Pray first for the person in authority that they be right with God through Jesus Christ. Pray that they be filled with the Holy Spirit and guided moment by moment into all truth. Pray that their heart and mind be guarded against the schemes of the devil. Pray that they might exercise their power to do good and not harm. Pray that God would not listen to them so much as that they would listen to and obey God. Friends, let us not seek to influence God on our behalf. Quite the other way around. Let us seek to influence the influencers on God's behalf. How are you going to use whatever access you have today to whatever power of this world God puts you in front of? If we're not prepared in advance, there's no way that in the moment we can find ourselves ready. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. It's a listener-supported ministry, so go to reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the email list, become a reconnector, become a ministry partner with us. When we come back, I am going to be talking with one of the people I actually love best in the whole world. His name is David Henderson. He's a pastor and he's an author, and you're going to love him too. This is The Reconnect. We'll be right back. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We're seeking to put God back in his place, right where he belongs, in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about. We're seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. Hey, while you're at the website, sign up for our email list. You'll receive timely equipping resources designed to help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday and bring God back into the conversation in ways that honor Jesus. Remember, we can't be gospel people out there in the world if we're not presenting the gospel in gospel ways. So let's be speaking the truth in ways that honor Jesus in our conversations with others. Again, the website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. Okay, friends, you know that at this point in the show, I generally have a conversation with somebody. So it is genuinely my delight to introduce you today to a brother in Christ and a pastor who I dearly love. So there are people in the world for whom we're so grateful that that it just makes us want to weep. And David Henderson is actually one of those people in my life. Like, just the thought, I saw his name on the schedule for today, and in preparing to talk with him, I got to tell you, I brought tears to my eyes. This is a pastor after God's own heart. And so I want you to get to know him. I know that this introduction will horribly embarrass him, and so now I will read his official credentials to you. David Henderson is the senior pastor of Covenant EPC Church in West Lafayette, Indiana. He has a doctorate of ministry and an MDiv from Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. He's the author of Culture Shift, and he's also the author of a book we're going to talk about today, which is Tranquility, Cultivating a Quiet Soul in a Busy World. You can check David out, and you can actually listen to sermons and cool stuff like that at covenantepc.org. David, my friend, welcome to The Reconnect.
Carmen, thank you. It is such a joy and a blessing to be with you as well. Been looking forward to this time with you.
I know. And so I will admit that having known you as long as I've known you, when I watched your I Am Second video on YouTube, I found out a lot of things about you that I, in fact, did not know. Mm-hmm. So I would love for you to just simply tell our listeners your story. What was your perception of church when you were a kid? Where were you at as a freshman in high school? And then how did you get from there to, to the reality that Jesus is real?
Yeah, growing up, church was mostly a matter of bribery on the part of my parents. They always said if we would go to church, they would take us to the donut shop on the way home. And that was, it took that incentive. I remember just us kind of doing everything we could to dash out of the church when we were done and kind of stripping off our church clothes. We'd always, my brother and I would wear shorts and t-shirts underneath. It's like, let me get back to real life. I remember sitting up in the balcony and being utterly bored and counting the beams and the light bulbs and the ceiling and chandeliers. And it was really by the time I came really out of middle school and into high school, I was an atheist. And I mean a persuaded atheist. I don't mean I just wasn't sure, but I was convinced that there was no God and that we were just completely on our own in this life. So God was really incredibly gracious over the ensuing years through high school and then especially in college to pursue me in a whole array of creative ways, some of which came with great pain, the loss of both of my parents in a plane crash when I was my sophomore year in college, some with real joy. I had the chance to take a trip around the world, and that really got me beginning to think about life in a completely different way. And all of that together, God used to bring me to a place where I became convinced of his reality and convinced that Jesus was the living key who unlocked everything that God was up to in this world.
So when you say, one of the things I know you say about yourself is that Jesus is the defining reality of your life. I think that that goes beyond the way most people would describe their Christian faith. And so when you say Jesus is the defining reality of my life, what do you mean by that?
Wow, that's a moving question, because it really does throw me back to my core understanding of the Christian faith. I think it's easy for us to kind of wade our way into the orbit of the church without ever coming to a place of really colliding with Jesus. And I think because of having grown up in the church and having just rejected it all as nonsense and then having come back to it, I came to Christianity as an outsider and found there not just this is a bunch of tenets we try to live by, or this is a ritual we do every Sunday, but it was, this is the living King of the universe whose presence alters, defines, lays claim to everything else. So for me, to say Jesus is the defining reality of my life means everything is from him, everything is through him, everything is to him. I exist for his sake, because of his decision, and for his glory. And yeah, so I think, your question is very perceptive, because it gets at the idea of there are always going to be exceptions to this, and it's my desire more and more each day that it would be true, but I would hope that every part of my life is something that you could trace back to Jesus, and in some way, it would be Jesus who would be the thing that explains that part of my life more than anything else does, my allegiance to him.
Hmm. So I have had the pleasure of seeing you in some environments that I would describe as unsettled. And yet in each and every one of those times and places, it doesn't really matter what was going on. I can now look back and I can describe you as a person who you were never a panicked mess, even if the rest of us were. And I think that this latest book that you've written, Tranquility, Cultivating a Quiet Soul in a Busy World, the reason that I can receive it as genuinely authentic is because I actually know you to be this kind of person. You actually are a person who seems to live at peace, even in the midst of great chaos and contention and controversy. So let's talk about Tranquility, the subject matter, and the book. Just talk with me about, the general busyness in which most of us live, and yet how we can experience the peace which passes all understanding, even in that reality.
Well, I think, I guess I would start as a framework, a couple of thoughts that I kind of try to unfold in the book. The title for the book comes from a guiding passage, which comes from Ecclesiastes chapter 4, which says, "Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind." And then the first third of the book or so explores that second phrase. What does two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind look like? And then the rest of the book is about, well, is there a better alternative? So what does one handful with tranquility look like? So the two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind, that is a description of our culture. I think... it's interesting. One of the things I had the great privilege of doing after seminary was living overseas for a year. And the person who provided the scholarship that let me do that said, "I really think that living outside of the United States is the only way you can really effectively minister in your own country, because you actually step out of the world enough of it to see it for what it is." And one of the things that I'm struck by is we are an absolutely clock-obsessed culture in the United States. And I think we've exported that to so much of the rest of the modern Western world. So Europe certainly is characterized by that, but Korea, Japan, there are a lot of other parts of the world that much of China now is that way, where we are driven by the clock, and that doesn't just mean a clock awareness, but we have this sense that there's something we need to be producing. We need to make each minute count. So it's led to this craziness of the way we think about time is, all right, I've got this massive list of stuff I need to get done, and then I've got this finite amount of time. So the solution is just to try to cram an infinite number of things into a finite amount of time. And so we have, you know, so many people have read time management books that deal with how do you do two things at the same time, or how do you skimp on one thing so you can get to another thing, or how do you shave off the unnecessary parts of your schedule so you allow every moment to be productive. And I think that there's something that feels heroic about that when you're in the middle of the frenzy, but something that just kind of is a measure of insanity culturally that we don't really recognize with one another. It's interesting. I think that that the whole type A, type B characterization started out as a diagnosis called hurry sickness. It came from somebody who noticed that people who were more prone to heart problems, heart attacks, had this a particular drivenness as it related to their use of time. And so now we have this much more neutral terminology, because we don't like to think of busyness as an unhealthy thing. We like to think of it as a measure of our productivity and our worthwhileness as people. So we are absolutely immersed in this world that says being busy and getting lots done is kind of the mark of virtue. So I think the model that the scriptures provide for us takes us a really different direction. And at the heart of that is the idea that, and it's interesting because this ties back into your opening question of me about what does it mean that Jesus is the defining reality of your life. The heart of tranquility comes from the idea that my life really is yielded up to Jesus. And I come into the day not thinking, how do I get more done, but what would he have me do? And that becomes a question and a conversation, a life oriented on him. And what are his purposes in this redemptive season between his first coming and his second coming? What are the ways that he would have me live my life between now and when I go to be with him? What does it mean for me to make those minutes count for kingdom things? But not everything is my responsibility, but the things for which he made and designed and fashioned me, those are my responsibility. So how do I discern those things from him? How do I live a life that is open and available and yielded and is an expression of his governance? There's a gorgeous image that comes through in a book by Frederick Buechner. The title of the book is Godric. You may have come across mm-hmm. this, where he talks about the idea that in this image, I am the glove that is on God's hand. And I think if we were to think of our lives more in that kind of a way, where he's the one who shapes my movements and my actions, I think that would really be profound. And then as soon as you start going down that direction, you start noticing things about biblical expectations that I think we just tend to sidestep as being awkward otherwise. Like the fact that the very first full day of human existence was the Sabbath. God creates a man, creates a woman, and says, here's your existence, so now rest. And actually, because of the structure of time, the first thing he invites them to do is sleep. So sleep and Sabbath as gifts that come from God, not things that God interjected after the fall because he knew we were a mess and needed it, but as his prevenient gift, this grace that he gave ahead of time, not something we need to earn our rest at the end of the day, but the rest out of which we live our life each day, then those things we start taking seriously and they become part of the rhythm and fabric of our lives.
I love it. All right, friends, the book is Tranquility, Cultivating a Quiet Soul in a Busy World. David Henderson is not only the author of the book, but the pastor of Covenant EPC Church in West Lafayette, Indiana. You can check that out at covenantepc.org. David, if we can we go back to the conversation that we started here at the beginning? Because first of all, I didn't know that you lost your mom and dad in a plane crash when you were a sophomore in high school. And so I guess I was operating under the impression that, you know, they knew that their son, who they raised in the church, who rejected the faith, you know, like I lived with the operating assumption that they were blessed to know that the prodigal had come home, but they weren't.
Yeah.
So can you just talk for a moment with moms and dads who are listening right now, who, you know, they were faithful to take their kid to church when he or she was little. That young person is now operating outside of the faith in some way. Can you just talk to them?
Yeah, and that's a great question, a very sensitive one. And the very simple answer that I would say in response to that is, I am a follower of Jesus because God was so eager in his love for me to pursue me and to woo me. I love the picture in Hosea where it says, I took you out into the desert in order that there I might allure you, that there I might woo you, that God wooing his people sometimes by letting them go through difficult circumstances. And I think if a parent, sometimes as parents we can get desperate about our kids' spiritual well-being and think, it's all on me, it's all up to me, nobody else is going to do it, my kid's not going to do it. And I think a place that that deep peace can come to us is when we realize that God loves our kids far more than we ever could ourselves or could even imagine, and that God delights to conspire in circumstances daily to appear before our kids and to awaken their hearts to him and to draw them to himself. You know, we just studied in our church, we just did a series on God passing before Moses and revealing his glory and his goodness. And part of how I pray for my kids each day, and they're at different places spiritually, kind of across the spectrum, is God, just pass before my kids, each of them today, in a way that where they get to have the privilege of a glimpse of your glory and your goodness, in a way that just moves their heart to bow before you. So I think the peace comes from knowing this is his project way more than it is ours, and that it comes out of a reserve of love that's deeper than we could ever imagine.
Mm. Hey, you and I have a mutual friend who I had the opportunity to sit down with just last week when he was passing through Nashville. And, you know, he's got a child who's just at exactly that place. And I think that invitation is so, it's so honest to who God is. And so, you know, we can certainly know in asking it that it's a prayer that's aligned with, you know, aligned with the Father's will and his nature.
Absolutely.
Talk with us. First of all, let me ask this question. Do you still take your shoes off periodically in worship?
I do. Not as often as I used to, but I do. And it's because of that very experience of Moses, of being in the presence of God, and just a way of reminding myself and not anybody else that he's the one who's at the center of this moment and not me. And it's my joy just to get to respond to him and honor him.
So you came to mind, and that whole that you were the person who sort of introduced me to that at one point along the way, that we really needed to be taking our shoes off and recognizing where we were in the presence of God. And and I had a conversation on the show a couple of weeks ago with the pastor. He was the pastor of the All Saints Church in Smyrna, Tennessee, when these Karen people came from Burma, and it ends up turning into this movie that's now out in theaters. And so it's about how, you know, a dying, in this case, Episcopal church has been completely revitalized by receiving into itself these Christians who had been evangelized by the Episcopalians in Burma over the past, you know, 100 years. And these people had come as refugees, asylum seekers, and they found, you know, they found this Smyrna, Tennessee to be a place where they could farm. Anyway, it's this beautiful, beautiful story of church revitalization and the reality that, you know, the color of our skin and the birthplace of our origin doesn't matter. We're brothers and sisters in Christ. But the story that he told reminded me, I mean, you immediately came to mind, because there's the conflict between these, you know, older folks who expect certain things about the way the rhythm of their little Episcopal church in Smyrna, Tennessee is going to go, and these immigrants who take their shoes off before they come into the sanctuary. And so the pastor is getting this lecture from one of these ladies about you know, the fact that these people don't wear you know, they don't wear their shoes into worship, and he said to her, okay, she happens to be a Southern lady who always wears a hat. And he said, you know, I will make them. Well, her concern was they were taking off their shoes and they were wearing hats. I think that was the conflict. And so he said, look, I will get them to take off their hats if you will start taking off your shoes. Because they were covering their heads.
That's
for the
great.
Same reason, you know,
yep.
Scripturally. Anyway,
yep.
You came to mind and I thought
That's
I'd share that
funny.
With you. All right. Thank you. You've been so generous with your time. But if you would be so gracious. Just tell people, because again, one of the things that I learned from you is an understanding of what the church is that I think many people no longer sort of have access to in terms of the way we talk about the church in our culture. So tell us what the church is and why the church is in the world.
Boy, I love that question. And I think... I would answer that coming from a couple of different directions. First of all, there is this absolutely stunning and breathtaking reality that that's described. We're starting a series in Galatians this fall, and so right at the heart of it is this idea that God's pursuit of me is such that he not only lays hold of me and then calls me into his service, but he lays hold of my heart in love and calls me into his family, and in such a way that I really am able to refer to him as my father. And instantly, by definition, that means that all of these other people with whom I have in common only my love for and allegiance to Jesus are my brothers and sisters. And I think to be able to shift our vantage point to see them as gift, not as institution or as these people I kind of got thrown in the pew with and I need to tolerate for this period of time here, but they are part of the very way in which the gift of the Christian experience comes to me. You know, they are the ones who embody the love and compassion and regard of Jesus for me when I'm in challenging circumstances. They are the ones who help me grow more and faster than I could ever grow if I'm trying to do it as the solo lone ranger kind of approach to the faith. But then, so all of that is thinking of it kind of with me at the center of it. And but I think that is part of how God means us to see the church. This is my gift to you. I put you in a family of people who will love you, and you will be privileged to learn how to love. But when I think about a perspective that has God at the center of it, and the regard is not just kind of what is he doing in my life, but what's he doing in this world, there's no question to me that so often we can think of the church as existing for its own sake. So how do we get people into our church, and how do we get more money for our church, and how do, you know, that kind of thing. But I believe that God means that we would understand that the church is first his kingdom instrument and agent, that that God is up to something amazing and in a sense seditious compared to the world's agenda, where he is undermining, he's seeking to overthrow and topple the world and bring it all under his rule. And the church exists for reasons that are beyond its own mere what happens within its walls. So one of the things we're privileged to do is to say, you know, what might God be calling us to do as a local church that we will benefit from not a bit, but that would benefit what God's doing in some other part of the kingdom or in some other church to the praise of his glorious grace and in a way that advances his kingdom. So that's the way we think about it, is, you know, we're his and we exist for his kingdom and his glory.
I love it. We have to leave it right there. Unfortunately, I'm on one of those crazy time limits. David Henderson, thank you so much for being with us today on The Reconnect. Friends, the book is Tranquility, Cultivating a Quiet Soul in a Busy World. That's all we got time for today. Visit me at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Have a great day and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.